Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. In this episode, I talk to Kelly Carlin about the human path to wholeness. We delve into Kelly's childhood and what it was like growing up with the influential comedian George Carlin. Recently, she started her own coaching program called Women on the Verge. With a master's degree in Jungian psychology and a coaching certification, Kelly helps women step out of their expected societal roles by empowering them to reclaim their true selves. She finds great joy in seeing others live fuller, authentic lives. We also touch on the topics of parenting, depth psychology, social justice, interconnectivity, and comedy. It was particularly interesting talking to Kelly about how her father, George Carlin, would react to many of the debates and political divides that are going on in the world today. And now I bring you Kelly Carlin. Kelly, it's so great to chat with you today on the Psychology Podcast.
It's about time. We've only been trying to do this for like, I don't know, probably 5 years.
Yeah, it's been a while, and I keep seeing you on Twitter, and I love the stuff you're putting out there, and I'm really looking forward to shining a spotlight on you today.
Thank you.
You've lived quite an interesting life so far. Yeah?
Yeah, I would say so, for sure.
Lots of like twists and turns and, you know, plot, you know, unexpected things.
It's been a good, full life so far. I'd like more of it. I'm not done with it by any stretch of the imagination, just in case anyone's listening. But yeah, no, I've had a lot of amazing, exciting things and a lot of times and years where it was difficult and hard and weird and all of that. But I feel very grateful for where I am in my life right now.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. So for people who are wondering if there's any connection to the comedian George Carlin, yes, you are his daughter, right?
Yes, I am.
That can be confirmed. That can be confirmed.
Yes.
And I was reading something interesting because an interesting article, because he had a bit in his 1999 HBO special, You Were All Diseased. He had a bit about coddling, you know, and when I was reading this article, you kind of had remarked that, well, your childhood with him was the opposite of coddling, even maybe to a degree where it's there, maybe there's a balance that needs to be struck, right? You have like extreme coddling on the one end, but then, you know, you kind of talked in a little bit about your own childhood, which might be an extreme on another end. Is that right?
It's complicated.
And you did a whole, you wrote a book about it, right?
I did a solo show and about my life with my parents and all of that. But I mean, my dad coddled me in lots of ways. And then in other ways, I was a typical Gen Xer. My parents, I was like, I was raised by wolves, you know? I mean, those of us who were born in the early and mid and late 60s, our parents weren't parenting. There wasn't a lot of parenting going on. There was in some ways, but for the most part, they were being adolescents when they should have been being parents. And so there was a lot of having to grow up fast and being the only adult in the room sometimes and being parentified and all of that stuff. And yet at the same time, my dad always rescued me financially and always rescued me in other ways. So I never had to kind of learn how to live with adult consequences in other areas of my life. So, you know, none of these things are that simple and that easy to explain. But I mean, the good news was that I knew I was loved. I knew I was cherished. I knew I was respected in many ways. And my mother had really serious addiction issues when I was a kid growing up, and she got sober when I was around 12. So once she got sober, our family life changed a lot. And my dad had certainly his own addiction issues also. But my mother was a drinker. She was an alcoholic. So that was really tough. But yeah, you know, parents are people doing the best they could. And my dad always was looking out for me and always worried about me and felt really guilty about those crazy years where he and my mom really kind of went off the deep end with drugs and alcohol. But at the same time, it was the era, you know, we were really, all of my friends' parents, we were all left to our own devices.
Yeah. Well, I know you're deeply interested in psychology. And
yeah, I've got my master's in Jungian depth psychology. Yeah.
And I love, we could really nerd out about that for sure.
We certainly could. I hope so.
part of my own interest in psychology certainly came from family discord. This is apparently the first time I ever talked. My mom and my grandma were arguing in the front seat of the car in one of their usual arguments, heated fights, you know. And I said, both of you just shut up. Grandma, this is what my mom's trying to say. And I did all that and said, Mom, this is what my grandma's trying to say, et cetera, et cetera. And they were like jaw dropped. Like, I think I was 7 years old. I don't know. They looked in the back seat of the car and they're like, what is going on here? You know, so I feel like being the peacemaker for me, and I don't know, I bring this up to see if you resonate at all with this, kind of led to a real deep interest in human psychology, because I feel like I had to be a peacekeeper in a big way as a child myself.
Yeah, I was definitely the peacekeeper in the family, 100%. I was an only child. And my parents argued a lot during those addictive years. So, that was my main role, was the peacekeeper, and always trying to figure out how to calm people down and sort things out between them, and, you know, getting triangulated because of that. And that's the parentification of the child, was what happens. Suddenly we're in their business. And so, yeah, when that happens, what happens to the kid is that all of your relationship with your own needs and your own desires and your own wants, all of the psychic energy you would normally spend on that part of your development gets stunted or gets put somewhere in a closet inside of you. And so you end up kind of coming out as an adult, or even as a young adult, with not really knowing what you want. At least that's how it showed up for me. Really confused about who I was and what I wanted, and even my own preferences and my own desires, you know. And really, that took me pretty much in my 30s is when I really started to discover that for myself, when I felt super safe in the world and was no longer, in my 20s, I ended up being with a guy and marrying a guy who I just was replicated my family dynamics, which was, he was a narcissist and crazy. And all of my whole job was to figure out what he needed and wanted in every single moment.
Scanning, as they call it. Yeah.
Yes. Total scanning. Yeah. Yes. 100%. It's exhausting. Yeah.
It truly is exhausting. And you almost start to, when you're a child, you get certain expectations and assumptions about the world. And so you start to think, oh, that's normal, this kind of discord, right? And then it feels normal in a relationship. No, I totally get it. There's one story I read, if you feel comfortable sharing it, I thought it was really fascinating, about how there was such an intense moment, you decided to create like a pact, or like have a certain, just to have some peace for a second.
It was a UN peace treaty. I didn't call it that in the moment, but that's certainly what it was like. But yeah, we were in Hawaii, and my parents were on vacation, like our first big Hawaiian vacation. And my parents just were arguing the entire time and doing drugs and drinking and everything. And I finally revealed to them the effect. I mean, it had been years that they'd been kind of going at this. And I think it was around 10 years old at this point. And I just finally let them see how much the toll it was taking on me emotionally. And I like let myself finally crack and scream and yell and cry and fall apart, basically. And like that stopped them in their tracks and got enough attention from them. And then I sat down and, like you said, just continued my role, which is, all right, let's keep this going.
Exactly.
So I wrote out, like, I, Brenda, and George Carlin will not drink alcohol or snort cocaine for the duration of the vacation, you know, and made them sign it at the end, you know, at the bottom of the document and all of that. And 20 minutes later, my dad went in the bathroom and my mom accused him of bogarting the blow. And then she marched down to the bar and I walked out and hung out with this girl who rented all the snorkel equipment all week and tried to stay away from them as much as possible. But yeah, I mean, that was like a real manifestation of that behavior.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering, you know, not only your interest in psychology, but how some of this maybe informed your own interest in comedy, because you're a comedian, period, right? That's part of your identity.
I don't consider myself.
No, you don't consider that.
Okay,
no,
I don't do stand up. Certainly, I'm not interested in a comedic. I don't have a comedic career. It's not what I do. I'm a storyteller. I have comedy in my genes. I have good timing. I can tell a joke. I'm not very good at telling jokes, but yeah, I mean, I know how to improv with people and stuff like that, but that's not my career. No, I'm not a comedian.
Okay. So at the very least, I think I can say with a good degree of accuracy that you are all around comedy, you know, like you're SiriusXM, you have a SiriusXM podcast where you interview legendary comedians, right? So you're in touch with that. And you did a one woman show, right? Called A Carlin Home Companion.
Yes, I did. It was storytelling, kind of a la Spalding Gray. So it was a lot of pathos and some humor too. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a stand-up show by any stretch of the imagination. It was really a storytelling solo show.
I gotcha. Well, you're an aficionado of comedy because of that. Do you like comedy? Do you hate comedy?
I'm not a comedy geek. I'm not an aficionado. Okay. I didn't really, my dad was in the business. I watched SNL as a kid. I loved Lily Tomlin, Carol Burnett, the Newharts. You know, I grew up on sitcoms and variety show comedy. I aspired as a kid. I wanted to be someone like Lily Tomlin or Carol Burnett and do sketch comedy. Wasn't in the cards for me for a lot of reasons, mainly because of my mental health and just the direction my 20s went and everything like that. But that was a dream of mine. If I was going to be in showbiz, it would been that. Really didn't meet a lot of comedians or any real comedians until after my dad died. I mean, like the week my dad died, and people were calling me up and talking to me and kind of taking me in, which was very sweet of them. Belzer and Lewis Black and Gary Shandling and Paul Provenza and Rick Overton. Ended up becoming very close with Gary Shandling, and still am very close with Lewis Black. Gary became like a mentor in life for me and really helped me get the courage to use my voice and find it on and do my solo show. We also shared a deep love of psychology and a spiritual path. Mm-hmm. Both of us are practicing Zen Buddhists. So, but yeah, you know, I'm not a person who like waits for someone's new special or anything like that. I think because my dad was in the business, it just wasn't a thing for me. I think being a stand-up comedian it takes a very certain type of personality and a certain drive and a type of person who really needs to be seen and heard a lot and has a lot to say in that particular way to the world. I mean, I have a lot to say. I consider myself a thinker and a communicator like my dad, but I don't have a desire to be on stage six nights a week like most stand-ups do. I mean, they have such a hunger for an audience. I found that I'm much more introverted than that, actually. My dad was pretty introverted too, actually. But he really, really needed that audience connection and approval and all of that all the time. So I kind of became part of the comedy world after my dad died due to my dad's legacy and due to the people I started hanging out with. And they really did embrace me. I mean, I don't know what I would have done if without having, you know, Gary and Lewis and Paul Provenza and people like that really kind of take me into their family. I mean, that's really what it felt like. I felt like the family of comedy really took me in. But it's not my life. It's not my path. But it is in my bones. I mean, genetically, I'm a funny person. So. What the hell?
Yes.
That'd be very funny today. But generally, I love shooting the shit with comics. I love making people laugh, but in a very casual, fun way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. You said that your father was an introvert. What other ways was there a kind of split between his public performances? Was he hilarious just in casual conversation?
He considered himself more of a writer than anything else. So he had more of a writer's personality. He was always going into his office and writing and disappearing like my whole life. That's what my dad did. He was always in his office working. Mm. He was not a person who was on around people at all. Did not want to be the center of attention. Never wanted to be the life of the party. Mm. Not that guy at all. Would never hang out in a diner or a deli after a show with a bunch of other comics shooting the shit, not his style. Would go back, to his own room, do his own thing. So very much an introvert in that way.
Mm. So, well, Kelly, I want to talk about you here. You're a Buddhist, right? Is that right? Or you used to be?
Yeah, I don't self-identify as religiously as that, but I practice mindfulness and I have studied Zen Buddhism a lot and really love the perspective and the path.
Beautiful. Yeah, I have such a great admiration for Buddhism and also for Jungian depth psychology, which you got a master's degree in.
Yeah.
We got to bring that back. It's not in the public conscience of most psychologists these days.
No, but it's flourishing in its own world. I mean, there's archetypal and imaginal psychology that stands on the shoulders of Jungian psychology. There's a lot of great thinkers, James Hillman being one of them, who really, you know, brought the, and he didn't want to be considered the father of archetypal psychology, but that's basically who he is. And yet, even though people don't talk about it, you know, depth psychology is the study of the unconscious. Freud was the first depth psychologist. Jung, Adler, who were students of Freud's, found their own paths and their own way of talking about it into the world. But any, you know, I think most people these days know about things like the hero myth and archetypes and the unconscious and the shadow aspect of personalities. And all of that is Jungian stuff. So it's pretty much in the zeitgeist without people really knowing it. And of course, there's a lot of cognitive behavioral stuff now, which is great. I mean, I had panic attack disorder, and without cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, I wouldn't have been able to get in my car again to drive. Yeah. So I love that kind of stuff. But I'm also a person who loves transformation and the process and the human path towards wholeness. That, you know, that's really what Jung held, was that there's this wholeness, this aspect of self with a capital S, where the person's personality is just a small part of who they are. And this bigger sense of who they are is really, you know, that thing we're always leaning into and wanting and seeking and searching. So I'm fascinated by that stuff. I'm fascinated by the human journey, healing, transformation. I think part of the reason I ended up doing my solo show, writing a book, and getting my master's in Jungian psychology is because of my always wanting to answer the question, which is, how did I get here? How did I become this person? What happened to me? And how can I help myself get out of my own way? In some ways, you know, so that's kind of my fascination is that, you know, how do we end up like this? You know,
Have you figured it out?
Well, you kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier, yeah. You know, that thing about being like ages like 4 to 7, where we have a certain type of cognitive ability, but it's very concrete thinking. And we pretty much assess the world and decide on how the world is and the rules during those years. And then we live by those rules the rest of our life. And they're so misguided. They're so, like I said, it's such concrete black and white thinking.
Yeah.
And we don't question any of it until we learn to question it. So that's a lot of the work I do, is helping people, just know that, like, hey, this is this thing you constructed. You've got a rule book in your head that's always going, leafing through the pages, trying to remember the rules for every moment. And most of those rules are bullshit.
Yes. You know, but to the credit of our brain, you know, it's doing the best with the information it had, you know, our brain, our prediction machines.
Oh God, yeah.
And, you know, I always like the analogy of like, our brain is like a weather forecast system when we're young. It's trying its best to kind of map and model the world and figure out, okay, yep. Well, what can you expect? And if your life was shitty when you're young, your brain basically starts to cement some neurons saying, life is shitty. You know, that's life. And I've always been fascinated the fact that fear unlearning is housed in a different brain system than fear learning. And that we kind of develop these unconscious, and I think this is where, you know, depth psychology is so important. You know, the unconscious fear learning is so predominant, and it takes active strategies to unlearn it in adulthood. It doesn't just happen automatically.
Absolutely. And that's, I think that's where both come in. I think the cognitive behavioral stuff is important, but also accessing and utilizing the generative resources of the unconscious to build ourselves from the inside up again, and to use the deep imagination and deep play to relearn that the world is not as horrible and scary. I mean, it kind of feels like it is if you watch the news.
Especially right now. Maybe it is.
But yeah. the version of it in our head isn't real. And so it is about unlearning, but I think it's also about really connecting to these generative aspects of self that you know, have wisdom and have courage and have a lot of creativity, to use, and to open up those floodgates in ourselves with that stuff, to really live into our fullness is really where my joy and my bliss is.
Well, you are speaking my language. Okay. I don't know why it went to that accent, but you are definitely speaking my language here. So let's talk about this, the coaching work you're doing, and Women on the Verge is the name of your most recent coaching program. And so how do you bring depth psychology into this coaching program?
So I bring it in by a couple of different ways. I mean, obviously it's my come from, it's how I look at the world. So part of it is I start to teach people I work with a little bit how to understand how the unconscious runs us. And I'm a certified life coach also. So I use some coaching language around that, like saboteurs, things like that. We work with archetypes. I do a lot of visualizations and imagery work and kind of trance imagery kind of work to help people tap into other aspects in themselves through through images or stories. I help also people see the narrative of their life. I find, having been a person who does storytelling about my own personal life, it really, really helped me in such an incredible way to start to tell the story of my life and to piece it together, and to even use myths to kind of see like the more universal aspects of all of our narratives. Like, everyone talks about the hero's journey all the time. There's also the heroine's journey. We do some work around the heroine's journey in Women on the Verge, which is a different cycle. It's more of a cyclical, and it has to do with healing our relationship with the deep feminine and the healthy masculine. And it's not just for women, it's for everyone. So yeah. I'm fascinated by people's narratives and teaching them about their own narratives and really getting them to understand that you can write a new story for yourself. You can walk away from the old story and heal it and write a new story. And so I use different techniques and things. I do something called voice dialogue work, which is shadow work. I work with people in dialogue with them. I teach people a lot of active imagination stuff, which is using drawing or movement and or writing in dialogue with, inner figures, dream figures, stuff like that. Like I said, a lot of deep imagination, deep play stuff. So that's mostly how I use it. And I think that's kind of separates me from a lot of coaches and a lot of coaching programs where it's more of structure and goal oriented. And we have that too in Women on the Verge. We have, I basically teach them a four part process. It's first thing you do is you have to appraise. You have to figure out what's going on. What's going on in my life right now? What's working? What's not working? What do I want? Like, this is a big question that a lot of women I work with have not learned how to answer, which is, what do I want? Because women are usually outer focused or environmental focused, or like you said earlier, the whole scanning thing, right? We're into scanning. So I get them to turn towards themselves, figure out what they want, what they need, what's going on, how's it working, all that kind of stuff. So there's this appraising phase. And then usually what comes up out of that appraising phase is that they start to realize that they they kind of know what they want, or maybe they do know what they want, but they also know that there's something keeping them from going there. And so the next part of the process is like a discovery recovery process. And that's where we use some of the depth psychology stuff. But that's where we go in and below the consciousness, we look at our narratives, our inner narratives. We look at the stories we tell ourselves. We look at our saboteurs, you know, the rules, the unconscious rules we all live by, like we talked about. And then once we kind of get more in relationship with ourselves, our more whole, full selves, then the next part of the process is this emerging, which is like, oh, now I've got more information. Now I know more of kind of who I am. Now what do I want? Now what needs to be renegotiated? And this is where renegotiating roles in our lives and relationships are so important. And I think that's a big thing that scares people from changing, is that they think, oh, well, I've been a mother my whole life, or a wife, or a career. I've been kicking ass in a career. Mm. And we kind of have these identities that we get really latched onto. But there's like other identities inside of us that have been kind of in the background or not allowed to come to the full table and be here. But they're kind of unlived lives and they're unlived selves. And there's usually that's part of that yearning and longing kind of emptiness that we have inside of us. And so I help them get in touch with those aspects of themselves and learn to, yeah, you are going to tell the world that you're more than this or this or this. And that is a little scary. I get it. And yes, your relationships are going to change. And yet, the like you were saying earlier, you know, this kind of idea of who we think we need to be for the world, that if we don't continue doing that, that the world will kind of fall apart and the earth will open. It doesn't. It actually doesn't. Like most people around us kind of see us more for who we really are. And, you know, and some people it's like, you know, like, oh, I've always wanted to be a writer, but oh, I can't tell my husband that or my kids that or my whatever that, you know, and then like they start to do and it's like their kids are thrilled for them, you know, or their husband thinks it's great that they're like expressing them, you know, whatever it is, you know, and there's some cases where some people come to me and marriages do fall apart and, you know, careers are walked away from, but these are things that were happening anyway in their lives and they needed some structure and support to get through that. I work with women who are mainly over 40 and, you know, are kind of in that facing that, like, what is all of this about type of moment in their life. Yeah. And then out of the emerging part of the process is really the embodying phase, which is this is where the coaching really comes in. And what I love about it is, and what is just so true about life, is that you aren't really going to change until you actually take action. And I know that sounds ridiculously simple and clear, but I don't think many of us really get that.
We don't.
And that it's in the doing is where the real learning actually begins, because it's where we're kind of all like scientists and experimenters. And it's not like it's like, oh, I've had these insights and I've had this opening and I understand more of myself and I'm ready to go ahead and it's going to unfold exactly as I think it will. No, you're going to step into something and you're going to try something and then you're going to come back and go, what's working now? What's not working? You know, you're going to start assessing immediately, because that's how we do life, especially when we're doing something new in life. And so I just love watching this. I've had this program going for about 3 years now, and it's just been so amazing to watch women who are really ready for a more authentic, fulfilling version of their life. And they just need community and some structure and some information and some coaching. And to watch them step out of their comfort zones and to step out of their ideas of who they think they were supposed to be, that's the big thing, you know? And that's the, you know, and the reason I started this work is because that's the path my life has taken. I always had this idea of who I thought I was supposed to be. And when I started to relax and just be who I am and live the life that really feeds me, boy, yes, things change.
Yes. Well, I'm sure you're familiar with Karen Horney and the feminist psychoanalyst.
Yes.
Who really gave Freud a run for his money. She's like, yep. You crazy. You're talking crazy talk, Freud. We need some feminist psychology here. I've been trying so hard to tell people about her. I wrote an article for Scientific American called The Underappreciated Legacy of Karen Horney, because she's been forgotten in the annals of the history of psychology to a large degree. That's unfair. She had this idea, this notion, the tyrannical shoulds. That's her phrase.
And yes, I remember this. We studied her at Pacifica. Yeah.
Yes, and this is what you're talking about. This is what you're talking about. And I'm glad that you brought this up, and that you talk about how a lot of women struggle with this. Of course, obviously, a lot of men struggle with it too. But there are unique societal cultural expectations that are absolutely gendered to a certain degree in our culture, right? That need to be talked about.
Yeah, absolutely. And men have their own version of this, 100%. I mean, and it's funny because and I don't know if it's a fair word to use or not, but what I really feel like I'm doing and helping women with is dismantle the inner patriarchy within them.
Interesting.
And I know patriarchy is such a buzzword, and it's kind of a trigger word. And it is so interesting you brought up her work, because it is a tyrannical system of thought. And, patriarchy has that kind of bent to it, in its most extreme form. If you've studied any Greek or Roman history, women were not treated very well back then. It was like the birth of democracy, and women were I think third class citizens at that point. There was not a lot of respect for women in those great thinkers. So it is this dismantling of this tyrannical should system, which is I think how I'm going to start to talk about it.
I'll send you the article.
Please do. I would love that, because we studied her at Pacifica, and because we're Pacifica Graduate Institute, where I went and got my master's, is all about Jungian and the sacred feminine and all that kind of stuff. So and we had a lot of kind of early depth psychologist stuff we studied, and absolutely.
I mean, awesome. Once you start going down that rabbit hole, your mind will be blown, because she was also one of the first humanistic thinkers, in my view. She often wrote about the importance of wholeness, and she's like, how come the field of psychology is not talking about the whole personality structure? It's just picking one part of us. And she also believed in growth. She has this quote that I love that says something to the effect of, well, we can grow and change up until the day we die.
Yeah,
it's too late the day after you die, but at least.
Some people think you go on to another lifetime and you're still growing. So there's those
growing?
People too.
Do ghosts grow? That's actually an interesting question. I think that's open for debate. Like, you never see a ghost like change. Like, Casper never looks different.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. But he still may be doing work on himself. Who knows?
There's a bit there somewhere, but anyway, I just think the more you go down that rabbit hole, and I'd be happy to load you up on.
I would love that. That would be awesome.
Yeah. So this is a direct quote from your own website. The world needs women more than ever to step up and claim their authentic power. It's time for women to get out of their own way, to step into what they truly want and who they want to be. When you commit to big things happen. My question from that is about this word authenticity, because I'm very, very interested in the definition of authenticity, because there's various definitions in the literature. Anyway, without getting too much in the weeds about this, I just would love to hear what that means to you. Is it like a self-actualized version of authenticity? Is that what you're kind of referring to?
I'm always writing about this stuff, and my brain isn't very hooked in today to all of that. But there is something about it is, for me, authenticity feels like there is a congruence between my insides and my outsides. And there's something about being free of cultural restraints or roles. So it's around that. There's this sense, and it's one of those words that gets so overused, and I hate to use it almost sometimes when I talk about these things, but there really is no better word for it. There is a a couple of things that go with it. There is, first of all, knowing yourself. That's an element to it. So knowing what really feeds you and what you really feel connected to in a very somatic way. It's a full body somatic. It's not just a mental or an emotional or a feeling thing. It's a full body gut kind of a thing also. And so there's this part of it's a sense of yourself, but it's also reflected in your doing in the world. Mm. And that your doing is aligned with your values, your own personal yearning for what you want to create in the world. And that there also is a sense of freedom of expression. You know, a lot of the women I work with and a lot of people on the planet, but especially women, you know, they always say, I just want to be free to be myself or free to express myself. Mm. So there's something that stops us. There's some fear. We talked about it earlier, right? There's some consequence that we fear is going to happen if we're in full expression, you know, really expressing our opinions, our emotions, our take on the world.
Yes.
And so I think it's connected. So, and that expression is so much, right? It's kind of our portal from this inner life to the shared collective space. And so there's a sense of being able to be ourselves while in a collective space. Mm. I think about young people these days, and I think a lot about how the world is around race and gender, those two things in particular. The language that's going on right now and the big push culturally on the edges of this conversation, which sometimes feels necessary, other times it feels oppressive, too much, you know, wherever you are on the spectrum of this conversation. Mm. But I think the impetus to all of this is that people just want to be free to be themselves and to feel safe being themselves in the world. And I think what people call the patriarchy, if that, you know,
triggered,
right. Whatever that system is that we're all pushing up against, whether it's white supremacy or patriarchy or whatever it is that it is this system that for power reasons kept people from not being their authentic selves. Like you have to play a role inside of my system, and here's your menu. Mm. You get 4 choices over here and you get 5 choices over here, pick and be happy. Mm. And I really feel like humanity is pushing up some sort of against some possibly evolutionary consciousness space. By opening up more options for all of this. These are the millions of ways that humans can show up on Earth now. I mean, you just look at the gender names for people, the fluidity of those words. I really do feel like, you know, as opposed to some sort of, I think it's both, but I think it's part of it's this kind of interesting human evolution of consciousness moment. And I think it also is a social justice issue for sure. It's both things. And I think they just show up in the culture. I think that maybe the human evolutionary push shows up as a social justice issue because now we're having to fight up against infrastructure and institutions and ways of thinking and, you know, things like that. And because that's the evidence of it in our culture. But I think all of us are just looking to be ourselves and to be loved as ourselves in the end.
Yeah, we complicate it, but when you get right down to it, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I recently had one of my favorite podcast episodes ever was with Isaac Prilatensky, who I recently had just a couple episodes ago, which I really highly recommend you listen to because I think you'll really resonate deeply with it. It's on the need to matter. He argues He argues that is such a fundamental human need that pervades so much of what we do. But his perspective, particularly that what I like about it, is that, and actually what makes him a standout in the field of positive psychology, is that he believes in fairness and wellness for everyone. Mm-hmm. And he says no well-being without fairness. He's this whole a big believer in fairness. He's a whole model about mm-hmm. this. And I think you're going to resonate deeply with it. So I'm just trying to think through, you know, you say it's the need to be oneself, but I think that maybe we can even just go a little even deeper than that. You know, it's not just because we don't just want to be any part of ourselves, right? It's not like,
right.
You know, I just want to be, why can't people just let me be my, you know, schlubby, you know, pizza liking Netflix watching self? No, it's, they want the part of me that can have a unique significance in the world is yeah. being inhibited, is being oppressed. And my gosh, there's no denying that through the course of human history, lots of people have been left out of the table who could have contributed amazing, amazing things and could have mattered in to human history in such important ways. There's no denying that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting, too, because some women I work with, and it's just I've learned a lot in offering this space and having a lot of conversations with women about what they do want. And there are some women who, and there's men too, but I work with women right now, who they do want to matter. And their mattering is a big societal one. You know, like they really want to make women feel safer in the world. Or, you know, I mean, I work with some leaders, women who like do nonprofits and things like that, you know, or entrepreneurs. And then there's others who want to just offer a space that's full of light and love to everyone around them. And it can be the smallest space, like a dinner, you know, like cooking dinner for their family or whatever it is, or working in their garden and their, you know, the beauty, or working in a community garden. And so I think what happens sometimes, and I say, you know, that's important that there's this thing that we all want to express something into the world, and it doesn't have, you don't have to be Oprah. Like, that's fine. Like, it doesn't have to be this big thing because it is always the human to human connection moment that's how we make a difference in the world, is the impact our presence has on our environment and those around us. And that you can create an enormous amount of change and ripple effect in the world by just treating people with kindness, truly, you know, because you never know who's having a bad day. And, you know, you never know what moment could really shift a person's life. So
true.
Yeah, I just, but, and it is interesting, this thing about mattering, you know, it is such a conundrum for us humans, right? Because we do matter. In some ways, we've shaped this planet. We've changed the nature of natural order on this planet. So clearly we have an impact on our environment, and clearly our interactions do matter with us. And yet that's always the big question is, you know, what is our purpose? What do we matter in the end? You know, we all become, you know, loamy soil in the end, basically, which is a beautiful thing, I think, you know, because we are part of this incredible life cycle here on Earth. So, yeah. And it's this real, you know, there's always that narcissistic part of it. The mattering part, you know, and you have to like, okay, well, is it that part of it? Or,
well,
you know what
well,
I mean?
Just so you know,
play with that.
Oh, yeah. Just so you know, Isaac has part of his theory is that some people matter too much. we had this whole discussion, and he absolutely in his theory, he believes some people matter too little in our society, but he thinks some people matter too much.
Yeah,
and we had a whole conversation about surrounding that idea, and he said,
"Oh, I can't wait to listen to this.
You're gonna love it.
He's
I just adore him, and I whatever I can do to kind of shine a spotlight on some of these people
who aren't as
well known, but they're in the trenches doing the work. You know, they're not like out there like on Twitter every day like yelling, but his work is so great, and he says some people are just taking up too much space because they're not letting others have any space, and I completely agree with that.
But God knows we just spent 4 years.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
someone who sucked the air out of every molecule on this planet.
Yeah. It's like if you turned on the news, you would think nothing else in the world is happening, right?
Yep. So true.
And something about that person. Yeah. And then the cosmic thing, that I think about that all the time, you know. I was just thinking the other day about like just doing the thought experiment. Like, what if humans live another 2,000 years, let's say, 3,000 years? No, let's go 10,000, long enough for human evolution to have a process on it, right? And that it turns out that in the grand scheme of things, we're like a really poor version of humans. Like, yeah, I just, this is the, how my mind works, you know, like, yes. like, you know how we have like robots on a line, you know,
yeah.
and then you're like, that was robot version 2.0, you know,
yep.
What if like 50,000 years from now, there are humans that look at us and they're like, what a failed, you know, part of the line that human was. And here we are thinking we're all so significant, you know, we matter, yeah. I matter. But like in the 50,000 years from now, they're like, it's so funny. They thought they mattered. They were like, you know, on the conveyor belt, they were like version 3.0 of humans.
Yeah, but you can't, yeah. you can't get to the 50,000 year old human without us.
Oh, what a good point. You know, even if they learned the lesson, right? Even if yeah. evolution learns the lesson to weed out a lot of our traits. Yeah.
One can only hope that, you know, our species figures out how to deal with our greed. You know, I mean, I really feel like sure. that's the downfall of our species is this inability to see how interconnected we really are. And what's exciting about these days, even though it's terrifying with climate crisis, I mean, I remember 24 years ago when I started studying with Thich Nhat Hanh, mindfulness, Zen Buddhism, and all that stuff. And he used the word interbeing and interdependence, which are terms that the Buddha was using 2,600 years ago, which is we are all interconnected. And every indigenous people understand that. All of them understand that. We moderns somehow forgot it in this modern brain of ours with this age of enlightenment. You know, which is yay for the Age of Enlightenment. Trust me, I'm all about that. Yeah. And yet we kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater a little bit. And so we are really now seeing that, oh, we are all interdependent. We are, the environment is not something separate from us. We are the environment.
Yeah.
And so it's exciting that we are, as a nation, because I remember 20 years ago thinking, oh my God, if the word interdependence could be used in the White House, I think we're going to be okay. Well, it's being used now around climate policy and stuff and really an understanding of how it all works. So I'm hoping that we are evolving even right now a little bit. You know, I'm a big Ken Wilber integral thinker person. I love that kind of stuff. And I really do see this other kind of integral third tier thinking kind of coming online a little bit. You know, I mean, we're all in a big culture wars over all the other stuff, but I think we're doing it a little bit. We'll see, but there is this human greed thing that's still in the way. It's a bit of a bitch.
And narcissism
Yeah. I mean, I think they're connected, don't you?
Yeah, very much. But whatever it is, we need some more transcendence around here. I think we can all agree on that.
We do. We need grounded transcendence, though. We don't need spiritual bypass transcendence.
Oh, hallelujah. I call it healthy transcendence in my book. But
love it.
Hallelujah. Love and I it. Distinguish that from spiritual narcissism.
So yes, where we're just going to all leave our bodies and all pretend it's all white light and angels. I mean, that's why I'm a depth psychologist, because I love the shadow, because I know that the good, juicy, chthonic part of existence, you can only live a full life by digging downward and bringing it to include into who you are.
Yeah.
And you need both. You need light and dark, obviously, but those who just want to, you know, go around or move over or jump around things and not through things, they'll get some temporary relief for sure. But the demons are going to still come knocking on the door.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
For sure.
For sure. Let's kind of end our interview today talking about some of your exciting projects and that you're up to. We already talked about, obviously, about the coaching one that's very exciting. But you also have the Kelly Carlin Show on SiriusXM. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I love that because I get to have deep, meaningful conversation with people who I think comedians are probably some of the smartest people on the planet. They're just thinkers. Yeah. They have to be. In order to do comedy, you have to be able to have like a meta view and the micro view and be able to just kind of go back and forth between those two worlds. And so I love talking to comedians and I love kind of bringing this kind of a space to them. Like we talk about all sorts of things in those conversations. Mm-hmm. And so it's very fulfilling for me. And so that's what I do. I have, it's like once a month on SiriusXM and I've gotten to talk to some amazing people. I'm just in awe of the people I've gotten to talk to, like Carl Reiner and Jonathan Winters and Eddie Izzard and, you know, and dozens of people I've talked to. So I feel so honored that I get to have those conversations with them.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's such a great show. And I just want to add some other people that stuck out to me, guests you've had. So Robin Williams, what was it like talking to Robin Williams?
Robin, he came and saw an early version of my one-woman show, and he was so sweet. He would text me every few days because I was just learning how to be on stage and do some acting. And so he was really checking in on me with that, you know, and talk about a person who he brings out the funny in everyone around you because he's like, he opens the sandbox and you get to jump in and play. Like I remember the first time I hung out with him, within 10 minutes, he and Rick Overton and I were like doing an improv about seals and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, oh my God, I'm improvising with Robin Williams right now.
Amazing.
It was so much fun.
That's
because
surreal.
He just plays and he grabs your thing and then he takes it up here and then you grab it and everything. So Robin, just another deep thinker, deep feeler, and just was so, so heartbroken by how all of that ended. But yeah.
How I would have loved to have had been able to have a talk with him.
Oh, yes.
From a psychological
and
perspective.
And so open about all of it, too. Willing to talk about all of it. Yeah.
Another person I thought was really interesting, you had Weird Al Yankovic. I grew up with him, you know.
He's
really silly and funny.
Yeah, and lovely. And with all these people, you know, they've got the silly side, but we'd also, you know, I kind of have this kind of thing that that's who I am. We just kind of go deep real quick.
Yeah. Well, that's what you do.
That's what I'll do.
It's wonderful. Tell me about the National Comedy Center work you do.
So there's this place in Jamestown, New York, where Lucille Ball was born and raised. And Lucy always wanted to have some sort of institution that would honor the art of comedy and tell the story of comedy. And 4 years ago, a few years before that, but 4 years ago, we opened up the center. I donated 90% of my dad's archives to the National Comedy Center. And it is an wholly interactive space. You go in, you go to a kiosk, you check your favorite comedians, movies, comedies, TV shows, all this kind of stuff. Out comes a bracelet with a little computer chip on it that holds your sense of humor. Oh, wow. And then as you go through the exhibits, they're all interactive. It's all audiovisual stuff. You tell the exhibit what your sense of humor is. You just hit it on the thing and it brings up all the things that you love and things that are on the edges of who you are, of who you love and all that kind of stuff. It's takes about 3 hours to kind of skim the surface of it. You're laughing the entire time. I highly recommend going for a 3-day weekend and really deep diving into it. They've got a permanent exhibit of my dad's stuff. So if you're a George Carlin fan, you can geek out on all of my dad's handwritten notes and calendars and interviews and all sorts of things. But it's got every genre of comedy, sitcom and movies, and it's got comedy karaoke and Lenny Bruce's trench coat. And I mean, it's just, it's a kind of a perfect place on earth. And every single big celebrity who's come through Jamestown or the Lucy Fest there every year goes through it and their mind is blown. And my hero, one of my heroes is Lily Tomlin, and she came and performed at Lucy Fest and walked through the museum and was speechless. She was so in awe of what we had done.
Well, I definitely am going to have to check that out.
You have to come check it out. It's awesome.
I agree. That's a tyrannical should that needs to happen. You're also executive producing an HBO documentary on your dad, which is directed by Judd Apatow. Coming out next summer. Is that right?
Yeah, coming out next summer. Yeah, we inked the deal right before the pandemic started. But yeah, it's going to be a two-parter. As you know, Judd did an amazing documentary on Gary, who was a dear friend of his, Gary Shandling. So we were really excited to have Judd come on board. He kind of ticked a lot of boxes for us, and his team of people are amazing. And yeah, it'll be a two-parter on HBO, and we're hoping to launch it in May, which is my dad's May or August. We're not quite sure yet. Hoping to have some special events in New York City. And so, yeah.
I definitely am looking forward to that. I want to ask you one question I asked people on Twitter. Any questions for Kelly? And there was one question I thought would be an interesting one to ask you. What aspects of today's world do you think would irk your dad the most? This person wrote, he often comes to mind when thinking of social commentators who are missed at this moment in history.
Yeah, everyone misses my dad right now.
I sure do.
I think my dad would be most irked by people who got fooled by Donald Trump and just really let themselves be hoodwinked by the most greedy, narcissistic human in America.
He would have some funny bits about Trump, right?
Yeah. You know, my dad attacked white businessmen a lot in his material. And people seem to kind of miss that, but he had a real disdain for white male business people in America. I mean, those are the true owners of America. And he was, you know, my dad grew up in Irish Harlem, they used to call it. Right next to Spanish and Black Harlem. And he grew up on those streets. And from day one in my life, my dad taught me how screwed over brown people are everywhere, but especially in America, starting with the native population, the indigenous people. So, you know, and of course he'd hate the PC stuff going on.
I was
going
to say,
he'd probably have something to say about all the genders and all that kind of stuff. But my dad really respected underdogs in our culture. My dad really was a person who always spoke out and fought for the underdog and really did not like comedians who punched down. It's a more complicated landscape these days. And I think some of those people who are on the very left and are very politically correct would go after my dad right now. And I think he'd probably go after them because he always went after political correctness. He felt it was a real detriment to human evolution. He didn't think less speech was really going to create more freedom. That was his main stance around that. So, but you know, it's complicated times.
It sure is. Well, thanks for being on my podcast today to kind of navigate some of this complication. And I'm a fan of George Carlin, but I'm also a fan of Kelly Carlin. So I must say. So all the best with this program you're doing, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the course. Are you giving people a discount? Is that right?
The year-long program is the coaching program, but I've got some other stuff coming up. I have a day-long end-of-year thing I'm doing, and then in January, I'm launching a 12-week course. Okay. So I'll definitely send you some links for all of that.
Give me all the links.
Yep, and we'll put up some special links for your viewers, for sure, and your listeners.
Cool. Thanks, Kelly, for being on the Psychology Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.